Hello, everyone, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. Coming up in The Blender, we talk to The Guardian newspaper's former Moscow correspondent Luke Harding about his new book, Mafia State. The book details his run-ins with Russia's FSB and looks at how security services have joined forces with organized crime and corporations to better serve the interests of the Kremlin.
The path to advancement in this power vertical in Russia is to keep your mouth shut and be unquestioningly loyal to your boss.
And a garbled reference to the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan gets us to thinking what happens when politicians are faced with a name they can't pronounce or remember.
Medvedev, whatever.
Don't worry about that one, Hillary. We probably won't be saying it that much longer.
From bottom of my heart, thank you.
Well, it's been a busy week at RFE headquarters here in Prague. We spoke with economist Joseph Stiglitz and Russian opposition politician Grigory Yavlinsky at this year's Forum 2000 in the Czech capital. It's an annual exchange of ideas and peace-building efforts founded by former Czech President Václav Havel. We've also hosted several high-profile visitors from RFE's broadcast region. Most notable among them was the president of Kosovo, Atefeta Yayaga. Yayaga, a former police commander, assumed office in April of this year. She comes to power at a time when Kosovo, now in its third year of independence, is engaged in a protracted struggle with neighboring Serbia over the fate of its Serb-majority northern provinces. RFE's Balkan Service Director Gordana Knezevic sat down with Yayaga in our studios to talk about Kosovo independence, the Serbia standoff, and life as the Balkans' first female president.
Kosovo is recognized by over 80 countries. So could you please tell me what is in store for next recognition? Do you expect the next wave of recognitions? And in what way the situation in the north can influence that process?
Kosovo continuously is paying efforts further recognizing the independence. But we have also to be conscious that only 3 years after Kosovo has gained about 84 international recognitions. And we are very much focused into the being a member of all of the international organization. The issue of the North, it's the matter of the rule of law. And because there we have illegal groups who are operating and they are kind of obstacle for the daily life of the pure citizen living in those three municipalities in the northern of Kosovo. Kosovo is the country of its citizens, is built in the principle of the citizens. And the future of all of the communities, it is within the Kosovo and with Kosovo towards the Euro-Atlantic integration. And all of these latest statements about the partition, about the splitting of the territory, the people has to go away of those former or the previous centuries' ideas. The people has to look into the today's century and upcoming process that has to come. Our country and the neighbor country of Serbia had a past, and we need to shape our future. Our future is towards the EU. The best way to move towards the EU is by supporting each other and not contradicting each other.
You mentioned the problem of the Kosovo North. At this time, is Pristina, official Pristina, institutions, are they doing anything to reach to ordinary people in the North?
There is a continuous attempts by the institution of Kosovo and by the leader of Kosovo trying to win back the hearts and the minds of the community, of the Kosovar community into that part of Kosovo. Intentionally, I say that the Kosovar, because no matter which group they belong, they are a people of Kosovo. They are the community of Kosovo. But I would like to encourage and continuously demand from Serbia that they have to get out of their support with their this illegal, or how they call it, parallel structure within in these three municipalities in the north. This is very illegal. Their involvement, it is very illegal in this part of Kosovo. So our interest is, and it is interest of all of those people there in these three or four municipalities in the north, that as soon as possible to be properly integrated into the institution of Kosovo. So Serbia has to cut off their support with the illegal or the parallel structures. Kosovo is built on this basis of the equal rights for all the citizens of Kosovo.
Being very first woman, the head of state in Balkans, as you are, is it making your job easier or harder?
Actually, this has the advantages and the disadvantages. I don't think that there is a difference of being a woman leader or being a man leader, because the workload and the responsibility is just the same. The change which had the first woman leader in that part of the Balkan, it is the change which I see it with a very long impact, not only for Kosovo, but for all of the regional countries. I don't want to get through and lose a time of seeing the bad sides of it, because I'm quite an optimist person and I see it from the positive perspective. Being a pioneer for the positive changes is something that encourages the individual, a nation and the country to move forward.
That was Gordana Knežević speaking to Kosovo President Atifete Jajega in our Prague studios. And now to Russia, where the plight of working journalists has grown steadily worse during the era of Vladimir Putin. Over the past decade, Russia has seen nearly all its independent media squeezed out of the market by television stations and newspapers that are friendly to the Kremlin. And the scenario isn't playing out in Moscow alone. In towns and cities all across Russia, regional journalists are running afoul of authorities for critical reporting on local issues. RFE correspondents Tom Balforth and Alexander Kuligin recently traveled to the Volga River city of Rybinsk to talk to one celebrated journalist who has seen his career come to a premature end. Bruce Jacobs narrates the story.
Once a local celebrity, former television journalist Alexander Zverkov now earns his living checking trolleybus tickets on the streets of the Russian town of Rybinsk. As he pockets a few coins, handing tickets to passengers, Zverkov says there's a touch of tragicomedy worthy of Chekhov in his career.
There is a great phrase, you haven't lived to the full if you haven't experienced poverty, love and war. Well, I've done it all. I had love, a cruel war with that mayor, and now 2 years of poverty.
Alpha Studios, where Zverkov worked, used to report critically on local issues involving City Hall.
Let's continue with the recent hot topic. 50 million rubles was the monthly subsidy for communal services for the Rybinsk administration.
But Zverkov says those critical reports ended up costing him his job.
I tried to tell Zdvizhkov that this was not criticism, that we were trying to bring his attention to certain things, that there was nothing personal about this. I told him it wasn't important that what I personally thought, because he was the mayor and that I was there as a journalist, obliged to bring his attention to this or that. I wasn't having to go at him, but he took it completely different.
Alpha Studios lost its battle with City Hall. First, electricity was cut off to its offices. Then their building was seized by City Hall security guards. Yulia Muratova, the founder and former general director of Alpha Studios, shares her painful memories.
We came in the morning to the office, and the whole building was shut down and guarded. There was a dispute over the property there between the municipality and a private company whom we were renting the office from. The entrance was blocked, and all our equipment, papers, and journalists' personal belongings were left behind, and we had never returned there. And the equipment also was never returned to us.
Former Mayor Yevgeny Dvishkov denies forcing the TV studios into closure, although he admits that he personally attempted to correct Alpha Studios' news scripts before they went to air.
Muratova was the head of that TV company, and I was keeping track of their scripts. I remember coming to see her with chocolates. I remember it. And with a bottle of a dry wine. I was saying, here's the truth, and here is the lie. I told them, write the truth and don't write the lie. But the conversation didn't work.
He had certain objections to certain scripts, and it was just the beginning, although we didn't have any mutual agreements or anything related to him. As a private channel, we were separate from the authorities.
By the summer of 2006, burdened by debt and exhausted with the struggle, Muratova sold her channel to a Moscow television company, which terminated Zverkov's controversial program after consulting with the town mayor.
I think in today's Russia, journalism simply does not exist. It exists only as a service to the authorities.
Zverkov's career tells the story of how local authorities, just like their federal counterparts, are primarily concerned with taming media in Russia. Many television and radio outlets in the provinces have been forced to adopt the state line or face closure, while local leaders rule their cities and regions unchallenged. Today, Rybinsk has only one private local television station, Rybinsk 40. It was formerly owned by the current Rybinsk mayor.
That was Bruce Jacobs on the fate of former Rybinsk news anchor Alexander Zvirkov. The story is part of an RFE series on the Russian media. To see a video of Zvirkov or check out the remaining stories in the series, visit our website at rferl.org.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنید.
Машал радіо Дамінік
Азатун ДТМ.
Радіо Азатун.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Local journalists aren't the only ones facing challenges on the job in Russia. Foreign correspondents, who often feel freer to report critically on the Kremlin, face their own pressures as well. Luke Harding, the former Moscow correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, was harassed and ultimately expelled from Russia earlier this year after he cited a WikiLeaks document characterizing the country as a virtual mafia state. Harding's since written a book about his experience entitled Mafia State. He spoke from London via Skype to RFE producer Pavel Butorin about what it's like to be targeted by the modern-day version of the KGB.
Luke, welcome to The Blender. Your new book is out now. Its title is Mafia State, and we'll get back to the title a little later, but the subtitle is How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. You were expelled from Russia, is that correct?
Well, I was deported in February of this year, 2011, but I was also summoned in November of last year by the Russian Foreign Ministry and had this kind of Cold War-style meeting in the Press and Information Department where I was told that my accreditation, my journalistic accreditation, would not be renewed and nor would my visa be renewed and that I basically needed to clear off and leave the country.
And what were the stories that you were covering in Russia? Was there a particular episode or a story that you covered after which, you know, the sky fell on your head, so to speak?
Well, basically, I arrived in Moscow in January of 2007, and about 4 months later, two of my colleagues in London interviewed Boris Berezovsky, the exiled oligarch, and I think probably Vladimir Putin's number one enemy. Now, I had a pretty tangential role in all this. I didn't speak to him. I wasn't at the interview. I merely phoned up Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin's spin doctor, to ask for a reaction. But my name was on the front page story, which said, "I am plotting a Russian revolution," says Boris Berezovsky. And really, from the very next day, my strange new life began, and the Federal Security Service, you know, what used to be the KGB, the main domestic security agency in Russia, just basically took a keen interest in me, and this happened in various different ways. One of the things they did on numerous occasions was they broke into my flat in Moscow, and they didn't nick anything like kind of burglars. What they did was they did this rather sort of spooky psychological stuff where they would move around household objects. They, for example, they opened the window of my son's bedroom, and we lived at that point on the 10th floor of an apartment block with a kind of sheer plunge down to a frozen courtyard below. They set an alarm clock, which went off at 4:10 in the morning and woke me up. And the idea was basically to intimidate me, but it was also clear that they'd done this kind of thing before. And to begin with, I didn't kind of know what the rules of the game were, but the British Embassy gave me some advice. They explained that these break-ins were well known. They were almost Moscow's worst-kept diplomatic secret, and that I wasn't the only other target, that diplomats had been targeted, that Russian embassy staff working for Western embassies had been targeted, that this was a sort of really kind of pretty frequent, albeit rather nasty KGB technique.
Your story reminds me of a spy movie out of the Cold War era. You talk about some strange man in leather jackets following you around Moscow, then a woman appearing on your doorstep, then leaving without saying a word. But what was it exactly that you were accused of? Did you face your accusers at all?
Well, I was never accused of anything, and this is a bizarre thing. I mean, for anyone who's seen the new, excellent John le Carré movie, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, it really, strange though it sounds, it really did rather feel like that. Not, you know, there was no Colin Firth, the British actor, and the 1970s sort of sepia tones weren't there. But what was there was this atmosphere of Cold War-style psychological enmity. And I never found out why these guys were persecuting me. I mean, I think, undoubtedly, it was linked to the kind of stories I was doing. I mean, I was writing stories which the Kremlin didn't like. I mean, I did a story at the end of 2007 about Putin's alleged secret assets abroad, which, again, is the kind of thing that is whispered a lot in Moscow by Russians and you know, Western journalists, but not much written about because it's obviously rather taboo subject. And I was summoned by the FSB. I had to go to their investigations bureau in the Fortovo, which was the notorious KGB jail where Alexander Litvinenko was kept, which Solzhenitsyn writes about in the Gulag Archipelago. And I had a kind of bizarre interview with a young major in the FSB who interrogated me about the Berezovsky case. And regular break-ins, which got significantly worse after the Russia-Georgia war in 2008, when I got back, I was reporting from the Jordan side of Ngori. When I returned to Moscow, the mood in official circles towards Western journalists was extremely angry and venomous. And we were basically accused of being spies and CIA propagandists and, you know, just doing Georgian informational work, if you like. And really, at that point, the FSB were doing something every day to me. Emails disappearing, break-ins at the office, windows open. They disconnected my central heating. They even left a kind of book on sex and relationships by my bed with bookmarked to page 110, offering advice on orgasms, with the implication being that I was doing something wrong or they were watching, I don't know. But the idea, I think, was that I would leave, basically, and clear off and stop writing irritating articles. But I didn't leave. I kind of got rather furious that the British government complained about this privately. This is in the spring of 2009. And then in 2010, things went quiet for a bit, but along came WikiLeaks, this gigantic leak, the biggest leak in history, when Julian Assange and WikiLeaks sluiced out 250,000 secret diplomatic cables. And I flew back to London in November of last year to go and look at all the Russian ones. And they were eye-popping. First of all, they revealed big-style corruption, which we can talk about, with this vivid phrase that Russia was a virtual mafia state, which comes from a US cable. But also, they provided kind of corroboration that what I was experiencing wasn't some fantasy, but it was all too real. I mean, the US ambassador, John Byrne, in Moscow, complains to the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, in a cable in 2009, saying that basically harassment from the FSB has reached what he says is unprecedented levels. And he also complains about house intrusions, which is what happened to me and numerous other people, becoming more bold and commonplace. So this was a great moment until I got this phone call from Nikolai, a junior apparatchik at the Russian Foreign Ministry, saying, you know, Mr. Harding, you must have an urgent meeting with us. And I said, you know, what's it about? And he said, oh, we cannot tell you. And of course, when I got back to Moscow, this is when they said, you know, no more accreditation for you. Goodbye.
You mentioned the WikiLeaks leaks about from the State Department, and I suppose that's where your title comes from, Mafia State. That's a pretty damning description of the state of affairs in Russia, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think it's damning, but I think also actually it's broadly fair. I mean, this phrase isn't my phrase. It's a phrase of a Spanish investigator who's been probing the links between Russian mafia and Spain, and discovered or said there were all sorts of links between the mafia, security services in Russia, and senior Russian politicians, including, he says, three ministers. So this wasn't my phrase, but I mean, I did agree broadly with a sort of generally pessimistic sweep of these secret US communiques, which also reference massive corruption inside Lushkov under the former mayor, Yuri Lushkov, and talk about basically money being funneled up the bureaucracy to the very top, a massive culture of rent-seeking and bribe-taking, suggesting that deputies effectively buy their seats in Russia's parliament. There are also other kind of mafia-like similarities. For example, this code of secrecy. You know, everyone knows that the path to advancement in this power vertical in Russia is to keep your mouth shut and be unquestioningly loyal to your boss. And the quickest way for your career to fail, or for the tax guys to fall on you, or the interior ministry, is to reveal secrets. So, I mean, I think that's a kind of interesting theme. And I think the commentary from American diplomats makes it much harder to bat away what I've written as you know, just one embittered journalist, because I think the overall thesis is correct, even more so now that Putin is coming back. I mean, this corrupt.
Would you say that the time of the группировки from the 1990s is long gone now? You know, the accepted narrative has been that Putin put an end to that war of different mafia organizations in different regions. Or did he act as a godfather, so to speak, who, you know, made peace among mob families? Has Russia, what I'm trying to say is, you know, has Russia's organized crime merged into, you know, with business and government?
Absolutely. I mean, my view and the US diplomat's view is that it's been streamlined, that it's been institutionalized, if you like, that we've seen it kind of brought inside the bureaucracy, and the kind of Russian state, if you like, large corporations, the security services, organized criminals have kind of morphed into a single entity. And what's undoubtedly true is the people at the top, fantastically rich. I mean, you only have to wander around the streets of West London or Sloane Square or Belgravia to see that most of these wealthy properties, or many of them, are owned by Russians. Now, are these people who, like Bill Gates, have had a brilliant idea and, you know, created something and amassed a fortune? No, they're not. They're people who've taken huge bribes and who've profited from the commodities boom and the fact that Russia is the world's biggest oil and gas exporter.
Luke, you must be excited about the prospect of covering a few more years of Putin's reign. Do you hope to interview Mr. Putin at some point in your career?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, I after about the first year, I never got any official invites for anything from the Kremlin. The foreign ministry stopped inviting me to their Christmas party, which was very unfriendly. But I think the problem, especially if Putin continues, is that there are a lot of people at the top of the state who are living in a kind of Soviet fantasy land where people like me, Western journalists, Western diplomats, are a priori spies, you know, hostile correspondents, etc., etc. And I just think this worldview, this rather xenophobic worldview, this rather, you know, backward-looking, nostalgic worldview, just makes Russia kind of intellectually off the pace, because the world has changed. You know, I've just come back from Libya. I spent 3 weeks covering the fall of Tripoli. I mean, things are moving with enormous speed and fluidity and dynamism in much of the world. But in Russia, we've just got this kind of dreary epoch of stagnation where essentially the aim of politics is to keep Putin in power and keep his team in power and ensure the survival of their assets. And I just think the model Putin has created is a really unappealing model. And I think the big question is, will it really last for another 6 or 12 years, or will at some stage sort of stoical Russians decide that they've had enough and do something about it?
Are you going to have your book translated into Russian?
That's a very good question. I was thinking that no one would be brave enough to publish it, but I actually had a couple of emails from people inquiring about doing a Russian edition, so I think there will be a Russian edition.
Well, I wish you all the best with this book and with any further creative endeavors that you might have. And thank you very much for being on The Blender. Thank you, Luke.
Yeah, thanks, Pavel. It's a pleasure.
That was Pavel Butorin speaking to Guardian correspondent Luke Harding about his new book, Mafia State. Harding was forced to leave Russia in late February after the foreign ministry refused to renew his accreditation. He's now based in London as The Guardian's senior foreign correspondent.
Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und McGee's, der hat ein Messer, Doch das Meister sieht man ihn.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet and television news to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Finally, a look at what happens when the worlds of politics and pronunciation collide. American politicians are known for their short, easy-to-pronounce names. Bush, Clinton, Gore, McCain. Even Obama pretty much rolls off the tongue. But in other parts of the world, the names can get a bit trickier. And no one knows this better than the Bushes and Clintons themselves. Correspondent Charles Dameron reports on the latest political figure left tongue-tied by an exotic foreign name.
What's in a name? For American politicians treading on the hazardous ground of foreign names, the answer can often be a serious gaffe.
Inevitably, the people of Belarus will someday proudly belong to the country of democracies.
That was former U.S. President George W. Bush, who on a 2005 visit to Eastern Europe mispronounced the name of Belarus, a former Soviet republic, as Belarus. But he's certainly not the first or last U.S. politician to mangle foreign names. The latest is Republican presidential hopeful Herman Cain, who made clear in an interview with a U.S. television network late last week that his time is simply too precious to waste on learning the answers to pesky questions like, who is the president of Uzbekistan?
When they ask me who's the president of Uzbekistan, I'm going to say, you know, I don't know. Do you know? And then I'm going to say, how's that going to create one job?
According to a recent Gallup poll, Cain is currently running a close second behind former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney for the Republican nomination to challenge U.S. President Barack Obama in the November 2012 general election. If the past is any guide, Cain's fumble is unlikely to hurt his political prospects. In her 2008 run for the White House, then-Senator Hillary Clinton was caught not knowing the name of Russia's incoming president, Dmitry Medvedev.
Who will it be? Do you know his name?
Medvedev, whatever.
Yes.
Yes.
The era didn't stop Clinton from going on to become U.S. Secretary of State, where she's been responsible for managing the United States' reset in its relations with Russia. In fairness to Cain and Clinton, foreign names can be a daunting challenge for many Americans. In Uzbekistan's neighborhood of Central Asia, the conglomerations of vowels and consonants can get downright ridiculous. There's President Nursultan Nazarbayev of the oil and gas-rich Kazakhstan. Or, even more forbidding, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov of Turkmenistan. Still, Cain seemed almost to relish his inability to name the Uzbek president Islam Karimov and called Uzbekistan an insignificant state. But many would argue that Uzbekistan is a relatively important country for U.S. national security interests. American relations with Uzbekistan recently made headlines when Obama placed a personal phone call to Karimov to congratulate Uzbekistan on its 20th anniversary of independence from the Soviet Union. It is widely believed that U.S. officials are looking to improve relations with Uzbekistan, which stands to provide the United States with vital supply routes into Afghanistan, should America's relationship with Pakistan continue to deteriorate. It's a move that has angered the human rights community, who say that the 2005 Andijan massacre of unarmed civilians and the widespread use of child labor in Uzbekistan's cotton industry make Karimov a poor choice as a strategic partner. But with the war in Afghanistan likely to remain a foreign policy priority, Cain and other presidential hopefuls might consider brushing up on the name of the man who controls a critical corridor into the war zone, not to mention the pronunciation of his country.
You Becky, 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 Stan, Stan.
That was the relatively easy to pronounce Charles Dameron, reporting on Republican presidential hopeful Herman Cain's verbal struggles with the nation of Uzbekistan. And that's it for The Blender this week. Thanks for tuning us in. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and just to prove it's not only politicians who sometimes fail the pronunciation challenge, we'll take you out with some of our own little wrinkles.
In her 2008 run for the White House, then-Senator Hillary Clinton was caught not knowing the name of Russia's incoming president, Dmitry Medvedev. I'm sorry.
That was the relatively easy to pronounce Charles... I can't even say his name.
Cain seemed almost to relish his inability to name the Uzbek president Islam Karimov. Islam Karimov. Islam Karimov. Islam Karimov.
Dolet Murat Yazkuliyev's...
Solzhenitsyn. 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 Okay, sorry. I'll do it again.
That was Gordana Knezevich. That was Gordana...
Cheremushki. Still live side by side in the name of the Cheryamushki. How do you say this name? Stvishkov. Stvishkov.
This is the Yevgeny.
Yeah. Yevgeny Stvishkov.
Stvishkov.
Yevgeny Stvishkov. Okay. Okay. What a mess. Okay. Sorry about that. I want to do it.